My name is Janet Grant. I'm going to be leading a session today on Kiss Sleeping Beauty Goodbye, which is not an original name as far as I'm concerned. It's the name of this book by a woman named Madonna Kolbenschlag, who is a nun, and she teaches at a Jesuit seminary at the present time. First of all, I want to tell a little bit about my own background so you know where I'm coming from and why I'm interested. I'm a Midwesterner, like many of you I assume are too, and I have a master's degree in educational psychology and have done administrative and counseling work in colleges, and also now have worked here at Holden Village for 2 years in a variety of different jobs while I'm here. So my real love is in the area of counseling and caring for people and doing things for people. And one of the another offshoot of that is my interest in feminism. I consider myself a feminist. To some people, that's a hard word to understand. And for me, sometimes it's a hard word to understand. This book is about feminism, and it's about theology, it's about literature, it's about psychology. It's a very broad book, and that's one of the reasons why I like it. Today, the format that I want to use is to give you a little bit of a background on what the book is all about. Basically, what I want to do is wet your whistle so that you'll go out and find it in the library or buy it and read it. I don't get any royalties or anything, so don't worry. But I think it's a good book for people to read, and I just want to give you a little background, first of all, on what it's about and what it's like. And then I have some quotes from the book that are a taste of the book. And I'll give those to you. I have them on sheets of paper. And from there, I'd like to have some conversation about roles of men and women, what they have been, what they are, where they come from, maybe where they're going, what they should be, what they are and what they aren't. So I'd like to have most of the time today be a conversation. So we are all either men or women, and we all have some attitudes, I'm sure, about these things. So that will be the basic format, but as I start now, I like to do something that I call tidbits. I have some things I'd like to read to you just to give you a flavor of what I've been thinking about and to start you thinking. Most of these come from a little flyer called Women's Network News. It's put out by the LCA Women's Caucus. And it's a little one-sheet flyer that comes out sporadically. It's not really very consistent as to when it comes out, but it has vignettes, reprintings of little stories that people have sent in or that have been printed elsewhere. And it's just a collection of things, and I would like to wet your whistle to start out with some of these that I think will have hit me along the way. But she doesn't look like a bishop. The first woman since at least the 12th century has become a bishop. During the period of over a year that led to the election of the Reverend Dr. Marjorie Swank Matthews as the first woman bishop of the United Methodist Church, many people objected to her height, barely 5 feet. Her divorce in the 1940s, her husband walked out, leaving her with a 10-month-old child. Her health, a mastectomy, and her age, 64. Bishop Matthews is one of 16 bishops elected in July, this was 1980, in balloting in United Methodism's 5 jurisdictional conferences. She was elected on the 30th ballot after a long campaign involving politicking, achieving visibility in the church, discussion about qualities a bishop should have, and building support groups. When Bishop Matthews was finally consecrated, the stole she wore was designed for a 5'8" person. It dragged on the floor. Her supporters feel that her experience with cancer, her divorce, and her years of single parenthood all are factors that have strengthened her and given her a deeper understanding of problems faced by people today. 52 and fighting. In her own quiet way, Kaylan Pickford is waging war against the network of advertisers in this country. And what she is tackling is the way we consumers buy and are sold everything from toothpaste to automobiles. Her cause is not so much sex discrimination, but age discrimination. Youth equals sex and sex sells, she says. It is a destructive equation. 7 years ago, as a recently widowed mother of grown children, she found herself staring at 45. Pickford set her sights on modeling, enrolling in a course to learn how to act in TV commercials. In her book, Always a Woman, she says that she realized then how profoundly society is conditioned and molded and moved by advertising. The youth myth says that only in youth is there beauty. The myth is a cutting, double-edged sword, damaging for a woman over 30 and for the young girl who is afraid to mature. What has she been given to look forward to? Applying for modeling work, Pickford was told she was too old or didn't look right. Attractive, as the dozens of photos in her book affirm, she was told she did not look like other women your age. She notes that 95% of advertising agencies in the U.S. are run by men, and that things get out of balance when one sex is calling the shots. Now, after 7 years of modeling, she believes that changes are happening to the minds of the population, although the changes in TV and advertising are only token. The median age is on the rise, and advertisers and fashion will have to follow. Who has the dollar? Fun and Games, Custer's Revenge. Have you heard about the video game called Custer's Revenge? It depicts Custer crossing a desert, dodging arrows, dressed only in hat and boots. If he dodges enough arrows, he reaches a young, naked Indian woman whom he rapes before being hit by an arrow. A spokesman for the manufacturer has stated, "We may hear something from women's groups or from Indian groups, but we want to stress that this doesn't appeal to lascivious interest. It's strictly for fun. The only thing that might be construed as violent is tying an Indian maiden to a post and ravishing her." How Stereotypes Work. This is from a book by Natasha Josefowicz, Paths to Power. He's not at his desk. He must be at a meeting. She's not at her desk. She must be in the women's room. The boss criticized him. He'll improve his performance. The boss criticized her. She must be very upset. She's having lunch with his boss. He's having lunch with his boss. He's on his way up. She's having lunch with her boss. They must be having an affair. He's going on a business trip. It's good for his career. She's going on a business trip. What does her husband say? He's leaving for a better job. He recognizes a good opportunity. She's leaving for a better job. Women are undependable. Can men be more than stereotypes? Men are a persecuted minority. The image of the ideal man is handsome, strong, financially successful, athletic, intelligent, emotionally cool, hardworking, a good lover, and a Mr. Fix-It calls up an impossible vision. Big boys don't cry or touch people in non-sexual ways or play for fun or show fear or cuddle or talk very often about their feelings. But they do pay the price. Men have twice the death rate of women from cardiovascular disease and cirrhosis of the liver. Men die from cancer at a rate 40% higher than women. Men outnumber women in all hospitals by 20%, and their stays are 15% longer. For all men, the suicide rate is double that of women. If men divorce, their death rate is 3 times higher than women who divorce. Men are 13 times more likely to be picked up for drinking while intoxicated.
Driving.
Yeah.
Oh. You said drinking.
What did I say?
Drinking. That too.
That too. You understand. I'm losing my place here all the time, that's fine. Men comprise 95% of all people who's in state and federal prisons. 79% of all murders are committed by men, and 80% of all those murdered are male. She said it 30 years ago. This is Margaret Mead. Consider what it would be like if we said to a young man, "What are you going to do?" And he'd say, "I'm going to be a lawyer, unless I marry, of course." And he'd say, and we would say, "Why, what difference will that make?" And he replies, "Of course, if I marry, I will have to live on a farm. I'd have to give up law." And when we ask why, he answers, "Oh, because it's good for children to be brought up on a farm." Now, if men had to consider that they could have one way of life if they did not marry, and another way of life if they did marry, the ways of life as different as being a farmer and being a lawyer, they might think twice about getting married, and they would certainly not feel that they had had free choice. Finally, a poem by a woman named Nancy Smith called "A Man for Every Woman." For every woman who is tired of acting weak when she knows she is strong, there's a man who is tired of appearing strong when he feels vulnerable. For every woman who is tired of acting dumb, there's a man who is burdened with the constant expectation of knowing everything. For every woman who is tired of being called an emotional female, there's a man who is denied the right to weep and to be gentle. For every woman who is called unfeminine when she competes, there's a man for whom competition is the only way to prove his masculinity. For every woman who feels tied down by her children, there is a man who is denied the full pleasure of shared parenthood. For every woman who is denied meaningful employment or equal pay, there is a man who must bear full financial responsibility for another human being. For every woman who was not taught the intricacies of an automobile, there is a man who was not taught the satisfaction of cooking. For every woman who takes a step toward her own liberation, there is a man who finds the way to freedom has been made a little easier. That's to give you a start in your thinking. And now I'd like to share a little bit about Kiss Sleeping Beauty Goodbye. Kiss Sleeping Beauty Goodbye is a book written, commended to me by a man who said, "This is the book that turned me around to understanding what feminism is all about." I considered this man a feminist to begin with, so I decided that it was a book that I should read, and I'm glad that I did. The men that I hear read it say that sort of thing. The women that I hear, the comments I hear from women who have read it say, "This is my story. I relate to this. This is telling me about my life." Generally, those are the comments I get from folks. First of all, I want to say, as Madonna Kolbenschlag says, it's a luxury to be able to be even talking about this. She says in here that, "No doubt these words will appeal primarily to those accustomed to finding insight, solace, and challenge in books. Yet millions of women and men who have neither the resources nor the leisure nor the possibilities of those who are likely to read this book are also the object of its message. The first step toward liberating them must be to liberate ourselves, for we are all culture-bound prisoners of our own time." The book is about six fairy tales. It takes fairy tales that are probably familiar to most of us, although after I read the book, I went back and read the fairy tales, realizing I had missed forgotten lots of details, and then I also realized that there are many variations on all fairy tales. But it talks about six fairy tales and talks about them in ways that they perpetuate the myths that we have about men and women and the roles that men and women take. It's not saying that that fairy tales are bad, but it is saying some of the things that can happen and that are perpetuated through them. Today, what I want to do is just go quickly over the fairy tales that are in here and give you two sentences, perhaps, about what the chapter is about, and then go on from there. The first chapter is Kiss Sleeping Beauty Goodbye, and it's Sleeping Beauty at 17. It talks about the whole idea of women waiting for the prince to come along and kiss them, and life will be happy from there on in. It also talks about being a teenager and buying into the advertising scene, like that one paragraph I read about advertising is such an influence in our lives. Beauty is equated with youth, and youth look to advertising to find out what it is that they should be seeking. The second chapter is about Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. It's called Snow White and Her Shadow, and it's about the mother-daughter relationship. Many of you have probably heard about My Mother, Myself. It's similar to the, and says some similar things as that book might do. It talks about the relationship that young women are a mirror image of their mother. And it also talks about some of the double messages that mothers give daughters, especially. Let me just give you a couple examples. One message might be, I love you, daughter, but sometimes I hate what you did to my life when you intruded. A second might be, appreciate your body, but I'm ashamed of mine. Just some of the double messages that we receive. Third chapter, Cinderella and Women's Work. And it talks about work in women's lives, the fact that women traditionally have chosen relationship first and gone towards career second, and stereotypically that there is the pull of work and relationship in our lives, and how can we balance that? How can we have the best of both worlds, the work and the relationship? The next chapter, when I first read the book, was my favorite chapter. It's about Goldilocks, and it's Goldilocks and the Search for the Perfect Family. It's about being alone. Goldilocks' destiny was she was alone. She was looking for her place in the family, but there really wasn't a place for her. And the reason why this was my favorite chapter, because I'm a single person, and it said a lot to me when I first read it, that we have to be a strong, solid person in who we are before we can depend on someone else or some other people in a family or a community for our strength. But after a while, the last chapter became my favorite, and it continues to be. It's called Beauty Exercises the Beast. It's about beauty and the beast and patriarchal systems, how beauty did learn that the beast, there was beauty in the beast, and she had to give up some patriarchal systems, based her familial system, her family, her father, being the one whom she had so much love for, and she gave it up, and actually she found that what she really wanted in life by being able to take that risk and challenge the patriarchal system that she had been a part of and thought was what she really wanted. The final chapter is really an epilogue, and if you have no time to read this entire book and you want to pick it up and get a sense of the book, I ask that you turn immediately to page 194 and read the next seven pages. And that'll give you an idea of what the book is about. And Mary Schramm, who has read this book, says that is her favorite part of the book, that she wants all of her family to read that chapter. Basically, what that chapter, the epilogue, is about is called Exit the Frog Prince, and it's written in the style of a letter. It's written to the dearest prince, and it's signed with love and hope, Sleeping Beauty, Snow White, Cinderella, Goldilocks, and Beauty. And it's about hope and new models. That it's not up to women to develop a new model. It's not up to men to develop a new model. We have to develop the new models that we're looking for ourselves. We have to do it together. And there's a favorite quote of mine in here that I use many times, and people that know me are probably sick of it. But it says, I can't find it, but it says, I don't want to be what you are, and you wouldn't want to be what I have been. So where do we go from there? We have to go together. We have to work on this together. And one of the things that this chapter says is that the white male has the most to lose. It's the scariest for the white male. Has the authority to lose, and has some big changes ahead of him. So that's a quick overview of the book. I said the book was about theology, and I haven't said much about theology or spirituality or anything thus far. That's one of my favorite things about this book, is threaded throughout the book there's a theme of theology. And it's a theme that's very difficult for me to understand and even to say to you. But I'm going to try. It's one that I'm constantly learning more about. Every time I talk about this book, every time I read more in it, I'm learning more. I'm going to be very simplistic about it, so that you have a sense of what's in here. She takes Paul Tillich and uses a system that I've written up here, these three words, heteronomy, autonomy, and theonomy. She talks about the progression or movement from and through those things. Most of you, I'm assuming, know what autonomy is or have a sense of that. The other two words are less familiar to most people and have been to me. I looked them up. In fact, the dictionary I had didn't even have them in it when I first... That's another side comment. This is one of the few books I've read in my life that I have a dictionary alongside. There's a lot of hard words in this for me. It meant a lot to me to have the dictionary there. Simplistically, though, heteronomy is basically ruled by self and by another, and governed by another. Autonomy is freedom, independence, more self-rule. Theonomy is a movement into rule through God. But the complex thing about this is that not one's not necessarily better than another, or you don't give up autonomy to have theonomy, that you retain your autonomy and to be a theonomous person, and that the movement not necessarily is linear, movement from one to the next to the other, but could be from circular, back and forth through. So it's not a very simple thing to move from one to the next, like, you know, from first grade to second grade. But that is the main theme of the book. She also uses a lot of literature. She quotes a lot of other books, a lot of other authors. One of the main ones that she uses is Bruno Bettelheim, The Uses of Enchantment, which is about fairy tales, uses of fairy tale. So for me, the book, it brings together a lot of areas. It's called, on the back it says it should go in the sociology section, but it brings together a lot of areas of study. I find it a very difficult book to read, and I don't want to say to you that it is an easy book. It took me a long time to read this book, and many times I go through it now and I see something that I underlined that obviously meant a lot to me, and now I can't even understand the sentence now. So there are some long sentences, and she's she's an academic person, and so some of it is written in more of an academic style. So I want to warn you about that, but it's well worth it. I think we're out of it in the bookstore. I just went through the bookstore before I came here, and I noticed they were off the shelf. So it's about $3.95 for paperback, and if you find it, check in the bookstore if you're interested. There has been a copy in the library. So anybody's welcome to look at my book. My book is mostly underlined, so... but those are the comments about the book, the themes of the book. I'd like to give you some sheets now with some quotes. We have about a half an hour yet. And I would like us to read those, and if they're out loud, if there are comments that people have about things I've said or these quotes, I'd like us to share those and have a conversation from now on. But first of all, maybe we should, are there questions or comments at this point? If not, another thing is, I'm not the greatest typist in the world, and so there are some really strange typos in this. So, a couple sentences are not even readable from my typing. And there probably aren't enough to go around to everybody. I think I have about 15 or 16 copies, so if you want to share, make it into a paper airplane and send it up there. Anybody upstairs want copies? You're welcome to keep these sheets, this sheet if you'd like to, or if you don't, at the end, just leave it on the fireplace here, and I'll pick them up and use them another time. This, again, is a sheet for you to, again, to wet your whistle. Maybe it will, plus it's supposed to give you a sense of how she writes. I've said you might be interested in her style or whatever. Here's one more. Anybody else upstairs need one, or over here, Janelle? Is there an extra someplace?
We need a copy in the tape
room. You need a copy in the tape room?
I want to see the titles, especially.
Jeez. That's my copy, so I'll share with her. No, we can share. No, there's two pages too. There's two pages. You have a front and a back.
Yeah.
What I would like to do is read these and have you folks read them, and then if anybody has a comment on a particular one, please say that. See those comments. So I'll read the first one, and then we'll just. Anybody can read from there on in. By the time they are 17, many young women have surrendered their ambitions to the growing need for affection and their autonomy to an emotional dependence on the approval and goodwill of others. The spell is cast, and the promise of beauty, of being desirable, lulls the young woman into an existential limbo where everything is measured by the expectation of the one who is to come.
I don't think that applies to today's young men. It did in my age, maybe a little bit, and the generation before that. I don't believe that.
Don't believe it's applicable
anymore? I think young girls are too smart.
Okay.
And yet I'm surprised at the college women I talk to that are in that very same situation.
I have two nieces who are 12 and 10, and they are very much into this path. Very much.
Seems like.
That's peer group acceptance right now for those kids.
What's that?
Peer group acceptance. That seems to be the big thing.
Uh huh.
Mm-hmm. If this can be.
Also for boys.
If this can be an individual thing, it can also be a group thing. Mm-hmm. And the young girls that I see around my oldest niece, who's 12, going on 16, is just very much this idea.
You mentioned and boys too.
Yeah, peer group acceptance. My grandson's 11 years old. He won't wear a blue pair of Nikes because kids will laugh at him. He has to have a white leather pair.
Can't have.
I also think some of this boy-girl thing is established very early. I have many grandchildren. These two happen to be cousins. The little boy at the time was 5, the girl was 4, and a mean little devil. Beating him to a pulp periodically, and he was staying at this house, went in and said, "Well, she's hitting me and all this." And finally, my other daughter, in exasperation, said, "Hit her back." "But Andy, I can't, she's a girl." Well, how are you going to get this poor lad up to 20-something on an even basis? "I can't do that, she's a girl."
And he went to a boy, do you think? And
apparently he would have slugged her, but good
if he was a boy.
Right, so I don't know.
It seems to me, I'm about 10 years out of college now, and I've worked with college students along the way, and it seems to me there's more of that now for college students in high school. My nieces are and nephews are in high school. More of it for those people than there was when I was in college. Maybe that was those 60s and early 70s thing where people were changing. There's more conservatives now, it seems.
It does seem like there's almost like a going back. First, there was a great breaking out and a change. And, you know, at least as I was growing up, I remember feeling quite free about my choices. And now I do see that same thing, that it's kind of a pulling back. And, well, maybe that's not so great or something. I don't know exactly what the reason for it is, but there is that. There seems like there always was still for me that choice thing. Well, you can be this, you know, as saying about 17, setting your life ambitions. But then if you get married, that's going to throw a wrench in the works. You know, kind of thing. There's always that double choice.
The either or?
Yeah. That a man would not have to worry about. Mm-hmm.
I'm curious that you really see some differences now.
I'm sorry, I can't hear the conversation. I mean,
you really see some differences now, you were saying.
Well, it just seems to me that they have so many alternatives. Mm-hmm. And the world has opened up for them. And I just feel that they are realizing it now. You don't have to get married when you leave high school or when you look for a mate in college. We live longer. And if they, it seems to me that I realize this, and I just thought they did too.
Unfortunately, biologically, it's still better to have women or babies when you're young, and if we're going to continue the race, we have to have babies. And unfortunately, there is a difference between men and women are the only ones that can carry out that chore.
To give the birthing.
Yeah. Birthing. Takes both, but women, I don't know whether it's fortunate or unfortunate. I guess it's fortunate where women were given that role. Had men been given it, the race would have died out years ago.
Why do you say that?
Why do I say that?
If men would have been given the assignment to have babies, and, why would that have changed?
Speaking for yourself.
Speaking for myself. I'd have never gone through that.
the birthing.
If we're given the same male personality traits that we have compared to women's personality traits, I said the race would have died out long ago.
I agree with that.
But if you'd grown up expecting that, you might not have.
I'm just saying we,
right,
giving the same personality traits that men and women are given, we'd have died out.
Did you want to respond, Ben?
Well, I'm wondering what personality traits there are that men have that women don't have, that men wouldn't have had children to perpetuate the race. Or if you can identify personality traits.
Caring, kindness, patience, acceptance of pain.
Those are male personality traits or female?
That's female.
Oh, see, I know
so many men who have all of that.
I hope we do, but not in the same degree.
Well, women know that they have to go through a 9-year period where there is... My clock just jumped. Women know they have to go through a 9-month period. I can't get that year out of my mind. A 9-month period in which they have, many of them, morning sickness. I haven't encountered a woman who is pregnant or who has gone through pregnancy who has said, "Oh, it was easy. I didn't have any trouble with it. My wife has borne 2 sons, and I know the things that she went through. I was empathetic enough. As a matter of fact, when our first child was born, we were living in Panama, and I was out in the jungles doing survey work, and I was anywhere from 50 to 100 miles away, 50 to 75 miles away. And believe me, every morning I'd have morning sickness, although I was away. Some people don't believe that so, but I did. And if I knew that I had to do that, I don't think I would. I don't think I'd go through that.
Shower.
I know, right? Men are selfish. I think men are selfish.
Absolutely. Well, I think that, that's one of the exciting things now, that women can make that choice not to do that.
No, not to do that anymore.
That's a genuine choice now that women can make.
And there are women who won't.
That's right. So, and there are women who are making the choice not.
Mm-hmm. But I hope the feminists who look at women who make the choice to be mothers don't criticize them for making that choice, not being alone by having a job. You sort of mentioned once that women should have jobs, I thought. Did you think women should first go out and do their own thing and have jobs before to establish themselves?
I think they should.
And I'm not so sure. But I just say, I think some of the feminists don't think women should be mothers. Well, I just do. They think they have to have a career to be the equal of men, and I don't feel that way myself. I think the greatest job in the world for a woman is to be a housewife. The hardest job, too.
Would that be a good job for a man, too?
Yes, the man should share in the housekeeping and the raising of the children, absolutely. I agree with that.
You had a comment a while ago, and then I'll come over here.
Well, I just had a question, sort of a question. We make a statement here that we're assuming this, and I was wondering if you have seen a change, because her statement about women surrendering their ambitions to the need of affection. A lot of my friends, both male and men and women, they have delayed getting married a lot later than their parents and their grandparents. And it seems like it's becoming something they're putting off later in their life. Isn't that putting their ambitions first? A lot of these are non-Christians, but they're still putting their ambitions before their need for affection. They're much more focused in on the I. And even in that, I don't necessarily see that as being good.
Are you seeing them that both men and women, that's a choice that you feel like they're making, or?
Well, I think they are, at least in my generation, are more making the choice of putting off the same feeling good about themselves and being focused very much in on themselves. Putting me first.
Okay. Vern, a comment.
I guess I think that we do now. It may be a little more, it may be a little less than 10 years ago or 20 years ago, but there are an enormous number of choices that we can make about our lifestyle. My great-grandmother had 12 children to raise 8. We don't have to do that. Mm-hmm. We can make a distinction between being a housewife and being a parent. I had a, you know, there was a time where you could have maid service and this sort of thing, and being a mother was a very ladylike, and maybe even had somebody to nurse your kids, very aristocratic, or it might have been a very complex thing. We can make some distinctions. We don't, neither the man or the woman has to put the, we have vacuum cleaner, refrigerator. I just think that there are all kinds of new choices that are the result of new opportunities and new resources for allocating work that make it awfully crucial that we make some decisions. That somehow we're into a wilderness where there are more choices, and you could camp here, or you could camp here, or you could camp here. And so I don't think I felt I had as many choices when I was making them.
Men and women, Billy.
I think you're right, there are more choices, but I also think that there are still a lot of limitations when you begin to exercise some of those choices. And I think society in general has not moved as fast or as far along as the individual.
Speak up a little, please.
I think there are limitations in terms of societal choices. Individuals have more choices. But when you run into societal patterns, then those individual choices are compromised in ways that you would like them not to be.
For example?
So a man decides he's going to put in X number of hours sharing and housework and child-rearing. The company may decide that he needs to put in X number of hours on the job instead, you know, in order to reach a certain position on the job. They're not going to be as interested in his child-rearing choices as he is.
So you're saying that changing structures is an important part of having your choices?
Go ahead.
I'd refer to the comment here on page 4. No, wait a minute. Page 53. The first step for any woman is the exorcism of her relationship with her own mother, dead or alive, real or mythical, loving or unloving, and so on. Why?
Responses? Go ahead.
I don't understand that.
Myself and many of my friends who are of my age, we love the woman very dearly, but as one gal put it, it's just now, and we're in our 60s, and I'm finally getting out from under this guilt trip she laid on me. I will never understand how she did it, and they did manage to do it somehow.
No, I disagree.
So I think this.
But it says whether it's love or loving.
Well, this is true.
Yours was a feeling of guilt, you said.
Yeah. Well, yes, for a lot of things.
A lot of women don't have that feeling of guilt. A lot of women have a great deal of love for her.
I have love for her, too, but for various things that you would either do or not do.
Why should you exercise? Why should you cut it?
Because I feel happier and freer now to do some of these things that are not necessarily sinful. Nothing very big, believe me.
What are you doing now?
This speaks very much to me and to my own relationship with my mother, whom I now love and always have loved very much. But there was a great deal of conflict when I was younger. And it's taken a long time to resolve that conflict in me. And maybe I can express it this way. My mother is a is an intellectually very bright woman who had a promising academic career, which she gave up to marry my father. And she gave me a lot of double messages as I was growing up as the oldest daughter in the family. They were, follow your own path and be independent and bright like I am, but submit yourself in a relationship to a man, that you can't go both ways. You can't go one way or the other. You have to do both as I've done it. That was one message. The other message was, don't get caught like I got caught.
And there was real tension in her between these two messages, and she passed them on to me. What has happened in the process of my growing up and maturing is the exorcism of those messages in my relationship with my mother, which makes it possible now for many wonderful things to happen. The best one is that we're friends, is that we've been able to become friends of each other, and each one of us finally realizing who we are as people, and not being caught in the same roles that we were when we were younger, either her as a mother, when she really wanted to be either a math teacher or an astronomer, and not a math teacher, but a mathematician, a theoretical mathematician or an astronomer, instead of a mother, you know, there's not the conflict now, partly because she's come to accept herself, but also because I've come to accept who I am.
Well, Pat, are you saying that you loved your mother when you were young, but you were not a friend to her?
Well, yes, we were not friends at all. In fact, there were times when we were very vigorous enemies, if you understand that word in the way that Holly Wells used it yesterday in one-on-one peacemaking. And there were lots and lots of conflicts, especially through my teens and through my 20s. Very many conflicts, and very real ones, that didn't break the relationship of love that we had with each other as mother and daughter.
Well, I guess I know I have been very, very fortunate, more fortunate than perhaps 99% of the men in the world. My wife loved her mother while she was alive and was a friend to her all the time. And her mother loved me when she got to meet me, and I was a friend to her. Maybe that was because she was a very unusual woman.
At the time, any parent is not friends with their children. You have to, every now and then the kids want to do something that you know isn't good for them, and you say no, and they don't like you for it.
I don't think that's necessary.
Yeah.
I see something a little bit more generic in there than just that. I mean, I feel a trip laid on me from my father. I think there's a quote, I can't remember what it is, but no man's a man until his father dies. That my dad has expectations of what I will do, and I carry those with me. And I think part of what's in there is, I think what she's saying is that you have to be your own person. Your parents, whoever they are, male or female, have expectations for you. Some of those can set up conflicts or whatnot. But you have to decide for yourself who you are and what role you will play, and not be continually trying to work out what was programmed into you culturally and through your family as far as what you will do. Maybe exorcism sets up too many negative images, but I think it's what I see more in that is for everyone to be themselves and become what you can be, rather than what your family or your culture says that you should be.
As I was growing up, my father said, I don't care what you want to be, son. If you want to dig trenches, dig ditches, fine, but I hope that you will be the best ditch digger that you can be, okay? Maybe he's laying something on me, but he gives me the full freedom to decide what I want to be.
We have a daughter that married Prince Charming 3 or 4 years ago. She unfortunately is in the process now of going through a divorce.
There he is.
She's wanted.
Going through a divorce with Prince Charming.
Tell us about it.
Okay. We had, in reviewing what was happening, with Amy, we have come strongly to the conclusion that we laid expectations on her in spite of the fact that we felt that we were a very free family in that regard. That many of the ways and habits that we lived by supported her marrying Prince Charming. There just was nothing wrong. He's an exceedingly handsome young man in normal terms. He's now going to law school at Oxford. The whole thing. Amy, after 3 years, said, "I just can't do it anymore." Mm-hmm. She just could not play the role anymore. But I think the most interesting, and obviously it's torn us apart to a great extent, but for me, I have seen something interesting, and that is, as we have told our family and told our friends and told other people, I'm absolutely astounded at the extent to which women are sympathetic with the situation that Amy has, women of all ages, and that men are unsympathetic generally with her situation. Mm-hmm. And it has been a real eye-opener for me. Mm-hmm. I have come to the conclusion that I, through my male eyes, am not able to see all that lays underneath the surface of that situation.
One thing from the Bible that came to my mind as we were talking was the thing about the new and the old wineskins, and kind of as a way of defining more what we meant by exorcism, maybe. Yeah. Because it's not a negative thing the way I see it. It's just a change, and we need that change. And, you know, we'll probably be doing something when our kids come along, if we do have kids, that, you know, they'll react against. And it's just built into us, I think, that we need to keep on changing and defining, you know, the things that are important to us, and think of it as a new wineskin.
Maybe we need a different word than exorcism.
That's what I think.
Yes,
I think that's defining.
The book is about liberation. I think you can consider it that way. Let me read this from her introduction. "It is finally what liberation means, that I have rescued my spirit from repressive coercion, from inner compulsion, and from the hazards of freedom itself." That
is a nun that wrote this?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
She's never surrendered herself to a man. How can she say she's liberated?
You don't know that.
Well, for a large portion of her life, she must not have.
She surrendered herself to a system that is very patriarchal.
Janet, I might just mention that Madonna Kolbenschlag is the theologian on the staff of the Woodstock Theological Center in Washington, D.C., which is Jesuit.
Teacher.
She is the only woman?
She is the only woman. But she is working with the men all the time. If you don't know the Jesuits, Madonna will tell you.
I wish she was here. Is there another particular area or a quote that you've had a chance to swim as a town in Washington, that you'd like to spend the last 6 or 7 minutes talking about?
Jan, I'm interested in what you think about heteronomy, autonomy, beyond. where have you gotten in your thinking about that kind of theme?
I have to open up to the page with the chart to help me crib notes. I think an important part of it is the understanding that you don't have to give up autonomy to attain some theonomy. That to me is something that is at this stage in my life popping out at me. At first it seemed like heteronomy and theonomy were very much the same, giving up to someone, something else. But the whole sense of theonomy is that you retain some of the autonomy, the freedom that you have in your life, and that you don't succumb to freedom, but that it is a part of your life. Oh, it's really hard for me to bring examples out of it all. Yeah. Well,
aren't we in a sense called to surrender if we're going to truly take our Christian beliefs to full extent, even as a married couple? We're not following what we want to do, what Lori wants to do, what I want to do, is what God wants us to do. And if we surrender ourselves, the whole idea of autonomy is we're given up. It's our entire lives is given up in that sense. We worry if we worry so much about establishing our rights.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe in a sense we should be worrying more about following what God wants us to do. And if I'm seeking what God wants for me, and Lori's seeking what God wants for me, and we both are seeking in that direction, I've got to believe God's going to pull us in that direction. And I guess maybe the whole idea of worry about who's in control, who's going to be dominant, isn't the whole idea of Christianity being servants, and that servants to each other?
Yeah, did you want to say something?
Well, I was going to say that I think that's a little bit in conflict with our creation in the image of God. I think that creation in the image of God speaks to the point that we are to be free, free from oppression.
Oppression to what?
Oppression by another person.
I guess I don't understand what you're saying.
It's only out of strength as I become more aware of who I am and who I am in the image of God that I can be that person in relationship to another person.
Sounds like we're looking at two different sides of the coin in a way, because they both go together.
They're very dependent on each other. The caring for self and caring for other, I think, are very interdependent.
I think the notion of the word surrender, too, is different here. I think the message that a woman gets of surrender is you become a doormat. And I think in order to surrender yourself, you have to know your gifts and what your strengths are. And I think we're encouraged to find those and then surrender ourselves in using those things for the glory of God. But I don't think that that's the message, at least, that I was taught of what surrender is. And I was taught that you pretend you're not smart, you pretend you're not good at something, you don't become a mathematician, you become something else. So I think that it's two different sides of that kind of measure.
I think there's some servanthood in one culture meant a certain kind of willingness to do shit work.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's to be a servant is to be willing to do dirty work that needs to be done. But in the biblical tradition, they don't use the term servant to imply that God wants people to be slaves, God wants to take enemies captive. The image is more of children. And so that our experience of God is of a God who wants us to grow up and be responsible, not of a God who wants us to stay children all the time. But I think there's some problems in our language.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right.
we get
mm-hmm.
tangled up in servant child imagery, but clearly, take the whole Exodus story. God wanted the people to grow up and take charge of their country so they could run a good show.
Mm-hmm.
And they kept arguing and not wanting to establish responsible relationships. And I guess what I'm saying is that God's calling. It seems to me God calls us to be as adult as we can be.
Mm-hmm. I want to read a quote from the book here that really has been the crux of the book for me for a while. Maybe someday there'll be another quote, but when the time, first time I, this hit me was Lent, very close to Holy Week, and doing a lot of thinking about, if you've never experienced Lent in an isolated mountain village, you might try it sometime. It helps you understand what Lent is all about, and Easter is all about. And we were nearing Easter, and I was sick of the snow, sick of some of the people I've been living with for months, and this made sense to me. Women have been conditioned to be passive recipients of suffering as well as pleasure. Their victimization in the childbirth process is a kind of metaphor for their social situation, an existence in which too much pain, Their victimization in the childbirth process is a kind of metaphor for their social situation, an existence in which too much within, too much personal autonomy, is surrendered for the sake of a role or code imposed from without. Spiritual maturity demands that women redefine the experience and the metaphor of childbirth by reclaiming their power over its processes, that they transform it into a symbol of their passage from passive victimization to active suffering, to pain and process freely chosen, befriended for the sake of new life. This is the heart of the theonomous conversion, the acceptance of temporary diminishment without the sacrifice of autonomy for the accomplishment of a purpose that transcends the merely personal and subjective. That, I get goosebumps when I read that. To the idea of passage from victimization, passiveness, to active suffering for the sake of new life. And I think that to me is what the theonomous existence is about. Is being actively, active suffering, active servanthood for new life.
Isn't a marriage a heteronomous situation to be successful, where each party has to give up a little bit of themselves to the other to be successful in your marriage? One doesn't give up everything. Isn't that heteronomous?
I think so. Mm-hmm.
That was my question. If you couldn't have some autonomy with heteronomy, like in the marriage of the two.
You have to.
You know, you both have to be individuals, but you both need to share and depend as well.
Remember I said it's not a linear thing. It's interactive.
That's right. But I was getting the impression that you sort of put theonomy as something bad.
I think theonomy is the goal.
Theonomy, all right. Well, they're all. I think it's a circle.
Okay.
But you're talking about heteronomy as being under the control
of someone else.
And I don't think that's good.
I don't think that is
I don't think that's good either, but you have to give up some of yourself.
I don't think you're meaning to say that.
No, I'm not saying heteronomous is you can't be completely autonomous in a marriage. You have to give up something to yourself once in a while, like the other party.
Even whether you're married or not, it strikes me, and actually, even people who are married are only married part of their life. They spend more time being a widower or a single person than you do being married. Whether you're married or not married, you still need interdependence. You can't live alone just because you live single. That human life is life in some kind of community, of which marriage is one form of, one pattern of community living. But I don't know anybody. I know very unhappy people in marriages who are living by themselves, although they're married. And I know very happy people who are single because they're not living by themselves. They're living with other people.
Yeah. I guess your assessment of my attitude towards heteronomy is probably negative, because I rankle under the idea of being under someone else's control. But the other two to me, and intermingling of the two, although I know there are situations where I am under the control of other people. You know, when I'm flying in an airplane, I want to be under the control of the pilot. So that, I mean, there are some relationships where that I choose. But.
Since this is so central, maybe we could define those even more and less. I mean, I don't totally understand those definitions myself. Or the time factor.
That's a good reason to read.
You've got a reason to come to the forum after this vesper time.
It is just about time to close. And so.
May I just say one thing?
But I'd like to talk to you more if you want.
I'm not an Alan Aldo.
A what? Aldo,
rather. I'm not a feminist. However, I have seen that women have performed equally as well as men in the corporate positions and in the government. I think that it may come to the day when the world can expect peace, that we're going to have more women in positions of power than we do today. Because I believe that women can handle the power better than the men.
And I think
that may be, now maybe the men want to kill me for saying this, but I do believe.
Many women would be happy to teach and share with men their understanding of power so that we could handle it all better together.
Mm-hmm. The conversation can continue now, afterwards, and also this evening and elsewhere. So. Thank you for coming. And.